And the latest research that came out for Ozempic, which is the chemical in Ozempic is semaglutide, is that 39% of every 1 pound you lose is muscle. And you go off the medication, you will regain weight. And we do know that when you regain weight, you do not regain all of that muscle back. You replace that muscle with more adipose tissue. You therefore lower your metabolic rate.
Welcome to Behind the Bite, where we delve deep into the real life struggles and triumphs surrounding food, body, and weight. I'm Dr. Christina Castagnini, a psychologist and certified eating disorder specialist, bringing you a unique blend of personal experience as a recovered individual with over 25 years of professional expertise. In each episode, we'll share the courageous journeys of individuals who have faced these challenges firsthand, alongside insights from dedicated professionals in the field. Whether you're seeking healing, inspiration, or simply a deeper understanding, this podcast is here to empower you on your own path to a better life. Join us as we explore stories of resilience, discuss the latest insights, and strive to foster a community of support and growth. Together, we can break down barriers, challenge stigma, and pave the way towards healing and living authentically. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to today's show. So I want to take a minute to set the tone for today's episode. I am joined by Melanie Rogers, who is a registered dietitian and the CEO and founder of Balanced Eating Disorder Treatment Center in New York City. She has been in this field for decades and is deeply respected for her leadership in weight-inclusive, evidence-based eating disorder care. Under her direction, Balance offers both PHP and IOP levels of treatment, and she is also very involved in professional education and shaping best practices in our field. In our conversation today, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about what's happening in eating disorder treatment right now, because we're both seeing some real shifts. And with those shifts are coming new clinical questions, mixed messages, and honestly, a lot of confusion for people who are just trying to feel okay in their bodies. We're going to talk about what we're noticing, what's missing from public conversations, and why it's becoming increasingly important to slow down before automatically equating quote unquote health with weight loss. This is really one of those episodes that offers both education and validation. So whether you're a clinician, a parent, or someone navigating recovery and trying to make sense of all this noise, this is really a great episode for you. So, all right, let's get into it. All right, Melanie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here, Christina.
Okay, so we have so much to talk about, but first, would love to hear a little bit more about you and maybe how you got into this field, if that's okay.
Yeah, would love to share that. A little bit about how I got into the field. Like many of us in the field, I have my own lived experience with an eating disorder, though I will say that was not my motivation, or I didn't even realize actually when I was younger that I had a full-blown eating disorder. That came later as I put pieces of the puzzle together as I was training up for the field. But what led me into the field was I happened to be doing my internship at the Obesity Research Center here in New York City when I was studying to become a registered dietitian. And I had come out from Australia, hence the accent, to do my master's here. And during my internship, I was at the center and they were working with individuals on treating binge eating disorder. And this is 25 years ago, Christina, I'm dating myself, but we did not have a diagnostic code for binge eating disorder back then. But they were treating individuals in higher weight bodies. And what was fascinating to me is that they had a multidisciplinary team. So they had, of course, a registered dietitian, but they also had a therapist. They had an MD, a psychiatrist, and a sports physiologist. And for me, it was this aha moment of we are not just calories in and calories out. And any struggles that we may have around our health or particularly around body shape and size is not as simple as just what you are choosing to eat, because it's so much more complicated than that. And so That was my introduction to binge eating disorder, which then led me to go and do more training and find follow other conf go to other conferences so I could get more education, etc. And that led me to then learning more about bulimia and then anorexia and of course the spectrum of eating disorders. What then I think was the hook for me, two things. One, with particularly specifically around binge eating disorder, what appealed to me around what I was witnessing there during my internship was my own grandmother had struggled very much throughout her entire life with her weight and was always being shamed by the doctors to lose weight. Family members would also shame her. She'd lose some weight, etc. But I just know her struggle. And then she died very young of a heart attack. So that heavily influenced me as a younger person around the struggle being in a higher weight body, health concerns, and just how difficult it must be for people to change their food habits. And again, it's not just calories in and calories out, it's psychological, it's emotional, etc. So this seemed to me to give me a bird's eye view into that whole piece. So that was a real hook for me because of that family history. And then the second piece is, as I mentioned, the more I learned about eating disorders, the more I was able to put my own pieces together and realize that, yes, I had actually had my own full-blown eating disorder. And because I blew my knee out and couldn't overcompensate by running, I was kind of forced into a recovery pattern that I only was able to identify later. So that's kind of more my foray into being really passionate about the field and having our own lived experience. It allows us, as you well know, to really know what's going on inside of our clients' heads, right? We've had the tapes, we've had the self-criticism, we've had all the obsessionality. And so often our clients, they'll probably say this to you as well, is like, how do you know that I was thinking that? How did you know that that's what was going on? And it's like, wow, even though your path is your own individual path, there's so much similarity. So that's what led me into the field. And then 16 years ago, after being in private practice for about 7 years, here in New York City at that time, there was only one outpatient eating disorder facility, and we certainly need more than one. So I opened Balance 16 years ago to try to address that kind of clinical necessity, if you will.
Amazing. I mean, that's much needed, but wow, that must have been quite a journey to open that. Like, can you talk about that a little bit? Just because, so many people really don't understand a lot. Maybe people listening about like outpatient and then higher levels of care and things like that, but just the journey to opening up your own facility, that must have been just quite an endeavor.
It was a bit overwhelming because I had never worked in an eating disorder facility prior, so I didn't even really know how one was actually operated. However, being in private practice and specializing in eating disorders, I had unfortunately referred a lot of my clients to residential treatment centers, which is a 24/7 care. And often they would go and stay for several months. And then once they're in a better place, they could then step back into, come back into private practice, seeing me once or twice a week alongside of their therapist once or twice a week. So, but as we know, that step down from residential where you're in a facility 24/7 and then you come back to just a couple of hours a week of support, we were seeing clients decline very quickly. So my motivation was to provide level just below residential, which is called day program or partial hospitalization is the technical name, which is usually about 20 to 30 hours a week. But clients, the difference between a 24/7 facility is that clients get to stay at home at night and on the weekends. And so it's a way to reintegrate into your life whilst it still getting a fairly significant amount of support. So that was really the reason that we wanted to do that, or I wanted to do that. So I went around to some of the key eating disorder providers in New York City and said, I think we need we, as in a community, need to do this
Mm-hmm.
here in New York. And I asked if they would join me and become an advisory board and tell me what did they think were the most important quality and aspects of what we needed to make sure we incorporated. So I had psychiatric input, I had medical input, therapeutic input, and also nutrition input. And so that was incredible. They were so generous with their time. And then I hired a consultant that had been referred to me who was able to get me from A to Z of just how do you open such a facility and what do you need to have in place. So a lot of very, very generous people who supported me through that process. The thing that I wouldn't recommend, though, Christina, is I opened right at the beginning of the Great Recession, not, of course, knowing that that was happening.
Yeah.
So those first 2 years with that amount of financial turmoil, and why that's relevant is New York City being, a huge finance industry here, is when things are financially uncertain, even with an eating disorder, people tend to hold off on, reaching out for care, especially if there is a large expense involved. And at that time, New York State said, we only need one facility. We gave a license to that facility. We don't need more than one. So we are not going to give you a license. So without a license, even though we were all fully licensed as clinicians and running according to, gold standard, it meant we could not accept insurance. So we were forced into a situation of starting out as a fee-for-service facility, and to provide that kind of service in Manhattan was incredibly expensive. So, of course, it was a very expensive undertaking for our clients to join us and pay out of pocket, which also is not what many of us are motivated by, right? We're not motivated by the money, we're motivated by the passion of helping others. So so it was all like a perfect storm. But anyway, here we are 16 years later. We're still around. We're still hopefully regarded as doing really good work. And I'm still here every day helping clients.
That's amazing. Oh my goodness. Well, thank you for opening another facility and sticking it out, 'cause wow, that's yeah. I mean, I've been in the field a long time too, and I just remember sending patients, and it was even a nightmare. Just even if they had insurance, I mean, still, even it's a struggle, but to get them
That's right.
approved for residential treatment, even if the place was licensed. So, oh my goodness. Wow.
Yeah, well, in the years since then, fortunately, there's been a lot more awareness about eating disorders just generally and nationally. And our state is now, very open to the fact that we need more facilities. And so we were able to get our license, which was fantastic, and get JCO accreditation, which, for those who are listening and are not aware, it's a national gold standard that you ask them and pay them to come in and rate you according to their gold standards to make sure that you're providing service of the utmost quality. So once we were able to get those two pieces in place, we were then able to go to the insurance companies, and we are now in network. And so we are kind of full circle with that whole process, but yes, it did take years.
Okay, so we've both been in the field a long time, seen some trends and things, and I
Yes.
know we were talking a little before we hit record here about one of the trends that I think is kind of a hot topic right now. So I'd love to talk a little bit with you about what you're seeing, and perspectives on where things might be headed. So wouldn't mind talking about that a little bit. I think most listeners are probably curious about what's going on as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're referencing GLP-1s, of course, there. Yeah, absolutely. So, as we know, I think the latest statistic is 1 in 8 US adults has tried a GLP-1, and that statistic's from 2024. So I think we could reasonably hazard a guess that it's more than that. And also the uptick in prescriptions or dispensing to 18 to 25 year olds has also gone through the roof. So it is young people as well as, the general population. And we're also seeing a phenomena where we have clients come in who are college age students and their family members are sharing prescriptions with them. So, for example, we had a situation where, I'm just going to make up a generic situation here to give you a sense, but, mum has gone through menopause. Mum is on a GLP-1 RA to try to address any weight gain. Daughter has gained freshman 15, is feeling distressed. And so mum shares prescription, the medication with her daughter. So that's just one kind of generic scenario that we're seeing, and family members kind of deciding to go on a health kick together, and all of the family members deciding to go on GLP-1s. So those are a few scenarios we're seeing, Christina. I think that a couple of things that are really concerning me is how many of our clients are coming in who truly did not know that if they went on a GLP-1 such as Wegovy or, Mounjaro, Zepbound, they are a lifetime medication. So many people have come in who actually didn't even speak to a doctor in order to get the prescription, not realizing that it was a lifetime commitment, thinking from what we're ascertaining that they go on the medication, they get to, a certain amount of weight loss in that first 6 to 9 months is the window that we're seeing. They stay on it till around 12 months and then they're coming off it. And the data that's supporting that trend is pretty robust. So what the concern there is that once again, the individual is being perhaps shamed or internalizing shame that if they're not able to maintain that weight loss that they achieved on the drug, that somehow they're doing something wrong. Whereas, in fact, that medication is a very, very robust medication that acts on two sites in the body, not only on the gut to slow down, the whole GI system, which means you feel fuller for longer, you lose your appetite, etc. But it also crosses the blood-brain barrier. So it impacts the reward system. So we're seeing people are moving away from high sugar foods, for example, moving away from highly processed foods and making different food choices. But if you take that medication out of the scenario, then you're left to just your own so-called willpower to try to hang on to things, behaviors that have been heavily influenced by a medication. So that's where we're seeing clients then go into a place of great distress. And from our perspective in the field of eating disorders, we're concerned that that's where people may then start to use even more restrictive behaviors or excessive exercise or laxative abuse or all the things in order to maintain that weight loss and end up in a place of developing disordered eating or even a full-blown eating disorder.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things that concern me with this and the things you're bringing up. Absolutely. I think, A, there's not enough education. Like, people actually, when I hear people talk about it, they actually have no idea that these medications were for type 2 diabetes. People
Right.
are actually saying, oh, the weight loss drugs, the weight loss drugs. I'm like, well, hold on a second. These are not actually weight loss drugs. They're not. That was a side effect of this medication that's been around for a long time for people who have type 2 diabetes.
That's right.
And I mean, perhaps maybe we could talk about this, but they're not taking the same doses as people who have type 2 diabetes either. And so that's another concern of, I'm hearing people who needed it, well, maybe not now, but before, people who actually needed it for their diabetes weren't able to get it because the people who are prescribed it for or were getting it for weight loss needed it at a higher dosage. So it was not available to those who needed it for their diabetes, which is concerning.
Absolutely. So, referencing when Ozempic came out, and as you said, Novo Nordisk is the pharmaceutical company behind the development of Ozempic. And Ozempic is an amazing drug for type 2 diabetes. Some of my clients are using it. And, to inject yourself only once a week instead of having to remember multiple times a day. And for some of my clients who are neurodivergent, Christina, or just busy in life, that can become really arduous. And so, a couple of my clients in particular who started on Ozempic more recently, their hemoglobin A1C, or it's a measure of blood sugar control, has been far, far superior to when they were on other insulin medications. So that was a wonderful thing. And pointing out to your comment there, when Ozempic came out, that was actually during COVID. And so then we were, then the side effect was, oh, there's weight loss, 10 to 15% weight loss is being seen organically on this medication. So what then happens and has happened historically is the pharmaceutical industry then has a look at that medication and they just whacked a new label on it, but they tripled the dose. And then they put out the same medication, but specifically for weight loss. Now, during COVID, though, we had supply chain issues. I think most of us remember running out of toilet paper and the
Right.
rush. You remember that? The
Right.
rush on toilet paper. Oh, it was crazy times. And so at that time, the government then seeing that, my goodness, we have a real issue here, and people with diabetes are not able to access a medication. So then they also authorized compounding. And so compounding is permitted, I've since come to learn, under very specific situations where there is lack of access to said medications. But now that the supply chain issue has been resolved because we're post-COVID, the compounding industry is actually now technically not legal anymore. But a lot of those compounding platforms have branded themselves as functional medicine platforms such as Ro, Hers, etc. So it's interesting to see how they're maneuvering from a legal perspective. But yeah, to your point, Ozempic at that dose, and then for weight loss, it's triple the dose. So people were, buying up all the Ozempic, and it was shocking to see, actually.
I want to get back to this compounding thing because,
Yes.
this is disturbing to me. I went on Groupon for looking, honestly, for like an oil change, and up popped, Groupons for, they were touting for these medications, and I'm going, wait a minute, these are med spas, these are places where people get massages, they're like all these other places, these are not medical facilities with licensed MDs or DOs, and I'm going, wait a minute, how is this happening that there's Groupons for these things where people go and get, other things done, like I said, massages or things. And so is this because of the compounding that you're talking about that people are doing?
My understanding with the compounding is it still needs to be, the script still needs to be read by a doctor. And myself, I have not done this, but several of my colleagues and friends have actually done this as an experiment. They've gone onto a platform, one of those compounding platforms. They've filled in as if a scenario that hopefully would make them be given a prescription, and they don't actually interact with a doctor, but apparently a doctor on the other side must read the application for a script. And so that's the technicalities. You don't need to be in front of a real live doctor. They just need to sign off on a script. And so they were able to obtain a prescription from without even seeing a doctor. So that would be my guess as to how the med spas are setting it up, that there's kind of an off-site third party way that they're being able to get around that.
Okay. I mean, but for anyone listening, I think there is this idea that these medications are for aesthetic reasons, weight loss, that they're healthy. I think you used the word when we were talking before that families were touting this as let's get healthy, quote unquote, together. But let's talk a little bit about like the side effects that people aren't, they're getting swept under the rug, I think. And that's the part that scares me. To your point, if they're not talking to an MD beforehand, before they're going on these things, there's not any informed consent, if you will, to understand like, hey, to your point, once you go on, it is lifelong. But also, here's the things that could happen. Here's some of the
That's right.
complications. Here's some of the other side effects of this medication that you really need to consider. And so those are the things I really want to talk about because when I talk to my patients about it, what? I didn't ever hear that. I heard it's like the most amazing thing. It's, every other day it seems like, oh, these are good for this now and this now, like other things. It's like the
Yes.
miracle panacea drug,
Yes.
right? And so that's like what's scaring me too, is like, what?
Absolutely, yeah, and I so hear you there, Christina. I think there's some impact in a positive way for substance use. I think they're using it or researching around Alzheimer's, of course, and several other illnesses. And I do want to say that I'm not a proponent of throwing the baby out with the bathwater at all, and that these medications can be really helpful. I think our main concern, and I'm hearing it from you as well, is just the lack of education that is not happening while people are kind of jumping onto these and seeing them as something that is very, very healthy. And my big concern is, obviously there's all the GI issues that people have with constipation and nausea, and if those symptoms are too severe, people are coming off them. But the research is showing us that just like any other really restrictive weight loss diet plan you might have gone on, or back in the day, remember those liquid diets, is that when you lose weight, you don't just lose adipose tissue or fat, you also lose muscle. And the latest research that came out for Ozempic, which is the chemical in Ozempic is semaglutide, is that 39% of every 1 pound you lose is muscle. 39%. Let's round up to 40% just to make that clearer. Why that's significant is that if you've lost, let's say you've lost, I don't know, 40 pounds, or let's say 30 pounds, because that makes it easier with my calculations. Let's say you've lost 30 pounds. That means you've lost at least 10 pounds of muscle in addition to losing adipose tissue. Okay. But what's significant here is if you don't stay on the medication and maintain that weight loss and you go off the medication, you will regain weight. And we do know that when you regain weight, you do not regain all of that muscle back. You replace that muscle with more adipose tissue. You therefore lower your metabolic rate. Your metabolic rate slows down. That's the rate at which you burn calories. So that becomes slower. And therefore, people end up not just back at the weight they started at, but at a slightly higher weight. And we now believe that it's actually weight cycling or yo-yo dieting, we've called it more colloquially, that actually is what does harm to the body over time, because you're basically in a scenario, a cycle of more and more and more adipose tissue being laid down on the body, and the body composition is going in the so-called wrong direction. So that I think people do not know about at all. And so, in essence, you're harming your body without even knowing that, and no one's telling you that. And if you look at the step one research, they did a 2 year, this was Eli Lilly, no, actually it was Novo Nordisk. They did a 2 year study. They put clients on Ozempic basically for 62 weeks. They then took them off and then they studied them for another 50 weeks or so. And at the end of that 50 weeks, they were able to say, clients were able to maintain 5% weight loss after coming off the medication for a year. But the reality is they were still trending up in their weight gain. and they didn't have them stay off the medication and measure at the same amount of time that they'd been on the medication. It was a shorter duration. My take on that as a person who reads research is that if they had, let's say they had measured at the same number of weeks on as off, and they found that people were not only just back to their weight that they were before they went on their medication, or maybe they were even higher. And we also know that blood pressure would have become worse. Cardiovascular biomarkers would have possibly been more negative. In other words, there would have been negative health outcomes that could have been measured at that point. You can't really sell a drug, I don't think, maybe you can, that you would then have to say, well, if you go on this drug, then yes, you'll get this weight loss. If you come off this drug, you'll end up in a worse place than when you started, which is the reality. And we've seen that pattern over and over and over for decades, usually through, significant weight loss, severe, restrictive, eating plans or diets. And we've even seen similar phenomena with weight loss surgery, which is, kind of when I entered the field, that was very big back then.
I mean, that, yeah, there's just a lot of unknowns too that haven't been used for quote unquote weight loss very long. And so even just not knowing all the long-term side effects is scary as well to me. I'm hearing other things too, like what it does it do to your GI tract long term? What does it do to your pancreas that was healthy? You didn't have type 2 diabetes, like, and now you're doing giving it a medication that was meant for that. Like, what I've heard of pancreatitis, I've heard it affects your thyroid. I've heard a lot of things that we're not talking about. And that's very scary. And I'm just thinking back, and I don't know how you feel about this, but I was thinking back, okay, if I was in the height of my eating disorder and these medications were out, I would have jumped at that. Because back then I would have done just about, and I did just do about anything because that's where my eating disorder was. My ed voice would have been like, oh my gosh, you have to get your hands on this, right? And so I'm just thinking of like, what are the risk factors for people who don't maybe even know they have an eating disorder or disordered eating, or maybe they do, and then they get on these medications. Like, what is happening here? What do you think? I would love to hear what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I agree with you, Christina. Back in the day, if these came out and I was in my eating disorder, I'm pretty sure I would have joined, jumped right on the wagon and used them as well, just to try and make that process of pursuing an unrealistically small body shape, a little bit less arduous. It is really super, super concerning. And so I think that there's going to be people out there who already have an eating disorder, even if they're not aware of it, who are going to be using them, which means I think that we're in a situation where if they were ever to go into treatment for their eating disorder, we would really be looking at having to taper them off the medication in order to get to a place of recovery, like if they wanted full recovery, right? So that's going to be a whole other new protocol that we don't have any kind of protocol for yet, right? Of how do you taper people in order to take them through recovery? I think we might also just see other people who are happy to stay on the medication and stay in their eating disorder for the rest of their life. So then there's all the different malnutrition side effects that we know come along with someone who is undernourished. Loss of bone mass, for example, so higher risk of osteoporosis, just to name one. You mentioned, the pancreas and the GI concerns as well. And right now there is some research that suggests for our clients with binge eating disorder, the medication may be helpful to quieten some of the food noise. And gosh, anything that could be helpful to our clients but not harmful, I think we all are really very much wanting to know and see if this could be helpful for our binge eating disorder clients. But there's two school of thoughts on that food noise that our clients often talk about. And one school of thought that I'm a big proponent of is that when our clients have food noise, that means that there's a lot of obsessionality around food. Often that is triggered by undereating in the first place or being too restrictive. So the fact that this medication is so-called fixing or quietening something that is prevalent because you're undereating in the first place, which is not healthy for you, then that doesn't seem like good science to me. So I guess as I'm kind of talking through this answer with you, it feels a little bit like the Wild West. And I'm not really sure how it's all going to play out, but I think we're going to see a lot of different nuance here. One other nuance that we've picked up on is clients with bulimia, which is when someone is overeating and then feels great distress and then feels a significant need to get rid of that food, either by voluntarily inducing vomiting or excessive over-exercising, etc. Some people are injecting themselves with GLP-1s on a one-shot basis as a purge. So that was a newer use that I hadn't heard of. And then, of course, we've been hearing about microdosing as well. So I'm not really sure, other than I think we're going to be learning a lot over the next year or so of different ways that people are using them.
I mean, I'm just even thinking clinically, and it hasn't really come into my practice all so much, except more of like people feeling more of like the pressure to use them, either whether it's from their medical doctors or just from watching people like they were following online, going from like bodies that they identified with to now bodies they don't, and feeling like, oh, wait a minute. Do I need to do this too? Because like I really like looked up to this person and they were talking about how they were comfortable in their body, and now they're in this really small body, and it's confusing for a lot of people. So there's a lot of dialogue about that. But, to your point, how much of it is going to come in where that's part of the eating disorder and it's presenting that way? And then clinically, how do you address that, right? Like, okay, do we start talking about getting them off the GLP-1s in order to really do the eating disorder work? Or, like it's going to be very interesting to see what comes about.
For sure, absolutely. And I think it's also interesting that, and understandable, that just like with eating disorder symptoms, a lot of times our clients are not so forthcoming about the extent of their symptoms or behavior use. And in the same way, we're seeing clients come in who are not necessarily telling us that they're on GLP-1s to begin with as well. So that secrecy or shame, non-disclosure, that sort of thing. So in other words, it's a bit of a jumbled mess, and it's hard to kind of know what's really going on in the full story as well. So that makes it extra difficult, I think, to figure out what is the appropriate treatment plan here? How do we approach this?
Well, because it, on the one hand, it's like I express concern and fear and want people to have all the information. And I think sometimes people can hear that as like, oh, you hate them and all this. But then the other side is I'm hearing, oh, they're just no information about possible side effects. It's just touted as this panacea and it's healthy. And I don't think they're healthy. I don't think they provide health to your body. I think it does the opposite, personally, I think. And that's what scares me, is like, where did this word health come from? And I know it's the toxic diet culture we live in, where if you're in a smaller body, you must be healthier, physically healthier, quote unquote. But I don't know. I think we need to have a real critical discussion about that. Like, if your goal is to be healthier, physically healthier, is this medication and losing weight from this medication actually giving you that, or is it doing the opposite?
I would I Yeah, I mean, from all the research that we know about being undernourished, and when I say undernourished, I mean eating fewer calories than your body needs, and therefore weight loss is an outcome of that. And especially to some of the degrees that these newer generation GLP-1 RAs, so that's the Eli Lilly that came out. Mounjaro and Zepbound, and they're not just one medication, but they're a doubling up of the two GI molecules or chemicals, if you will, hormones. And the third generation that's coming out is a tripling. So there's three gut hormones that are used in those, and they're shooting for or attempting to get to 25% and 30% weight loss with those medications. As a comparison, Ozempic was achieving or does achieve around a 15% weight loss. So what we're concerned about, and for the audience out there, some people may be saying, well, that's great, more weight loss is better, again, healthier. But we do know that with each percentage of weight loss increase, you're harming organs, because when you're eating those few calories, your body has to seek out fuel from a different source than the food you're taking in. So yes, it does start to break down some of your adipose tissue, but as we mentioned, it's also breaking down your muscles, and organs are made of muscles, including the brain. And we know that the brain starts to atrophy with this kind of significant weight loss. And what that means is that your thinking becomes less clear, and your prefrontal cortex, which is the front part of the brain that helps you in decision making and being reasonable, making reasonable decisions, that starts to go offline. And we know this from the Minnesota Starvation Study that was done during the Second World War, Christina. Those gentlemen, those conscientious objectors, they were put into a weight on a weight loss plan that achieved 25% weight loss. So that's where we are with the GLP-1s, right? It's the same amount of weight loss. And they were held at that level for 6 months. And they saw all sorts of mental health concerns, increase in anxiety, increase in depression, increase in rigidity, increase in obsessionality and rumination. Some of the guys in that program, in that experiment, actually self-harmed themselves in order to get out of the experiment, because it was so overwhelming thinking about food and being food deprived day in and day out. So there's just so much that we know from the research that when you lay it over top and parallel it with what we're seeing now, it's concerning. And again, I think we want to support something that could promote health for people. Certainly don't want to be, the stick in the mud or whatnot, but there is a lot that isn't being educated, that clients are not being educated on, and people are not talking about. So I think it's wonderful that you're taking the time to put a spotlight on this.
Yeah, and you have so much knowledge and information that I'm glad you're talking about it. Because a lot of people don't. All they're saying is, well, bottom line is people are losing weight, they're healthier, great, perfect. Again, just more of the is really being in a smaller body mean you're healthier? I don't think so. No, I mean, I've said this several times on my podcast. People in smaller bodies are often looked over in their doctor's offices and given the pat on the back, but maybe genetically they're not meant to be in those smaller bodies. They're doing things that are harmful to their
That's right.
bodies to be in
That's
those
right.
smaller bodies.
That's right.
And then that's where you and I come in, right? Like people who have, eating disorders and are starving themselves or doing things to be in those smaller bodies end up in treatment with us, right?
That's right.
But yet here we are giving people medications so that they have that induced for them, that they are malnourished and not eating enough and have the weight loss. And then everyone's like patting them on the back saying, good job.
That's exactly right. And you touched upon a phrasing there, Christina, that I came across in reading more about these medications. Medically induced anorexia was actually what I read, and I thought that's pretty right on the money, So we need to be prepared, and I think it's also, when we're talking about healthier, it is interesting to me that when you look at longevity and you look at mortality rates, in fact, we have this idea, as you said, this conflation. We've conflated weight with health, and the smaller you are, within a certain degree, the healthier you are. But we actually know that the people who live the longest and are the healthiest are people with BMIs between 24 and 27, which technically is when we start to get into what BMI would say is overweight territory. So isn't that interesting that if you look at the longevity studies, we actually need a couple of extra pounds, or at least be in our optimal weight, the optimal weight for our body, which is very individual and depends on our genetics, right? And so, as you rightly said, anything that takes you away from the optimal weight for your body to function optimally is going to be harmful. And that's our concern with these medications. That's our concern with eating disorders. That's our concern with people restricting, or in the same way, overeating for emotional needs or psychological needs, and their body therefore not being at a place that was optimal for them genetically. That is also a concern.
Yeah, no, that's well said. I know, and I hate the BMI anyway, but I
Yes,
think you were
well,
just making a point of if we're
yes,
gonna have
yeah.
that as the standard, Unfortunately, I don't know why it still is, but
So inaccurate, right? Yes.
yeah, one day my wish is it's abolished, but well, you've given so much wonderful information. Hopefully people who've stayed and listened for the entire conversation of some things to think about, or it's brought up some things maybe they hadn't really, thought about themselves. So, thank you for all this wonderful information. I know you talked about, where you work. So if people do want to get in touch with you or find out more about balance, how can they find you and get in touch?
Absolutely. So our website is balancedtx.com. That's balance with a D and a TX.com. And they can contact us through there. There's also a phone number, 212-645-6903. And it's absolutely our pleasure to support anyone, or if you have questions, I'm very happy to talk more on this topic or others. But it's been a pleasure, Christina.
Well, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening today. Behind the Bite podcast is created by me, Dr. Christina Castanini, as part of the Los Angeles Tribune Podcast Network and produced by the Tweaky Tales. I love hearing from my listeners. So if you like the show, please like, rate, and subscribe to it on whatever platform you're on. And for anyone who wants to understand their relationship with food better, or who might be wondering if they have an eating disorder, I have a free 9-week e-course at my website. Just go to www.behindthebitepodcast.com to get your free e-course today. Please note, this podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regard to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither host, the publisher, or the guests are rendering legal, clinical, or other professional information. If you want or need a professional, you should find one to work with who can address your individual needs and situation.